Good morning. Are you ready for a raucous story? We have a jewel this morning. One of those passages you always read this story, the Stephen speech, blah, 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 and then they kill him, which I always thought was a little unfair. Until you read the speech. And then it's a different story. So, welcome to Kerygma. We are in about a six-month period just kind of working our way through the book of Acts, slowly, methodically. Acts being the only first century version of the church history you have, covering those first 30 years. Scholars have said really more happened in the Christian faith the first 20 than in the next 300. So we're going through that period when so much is going on. There's so much nuance and stuff. So last week, Luke introduced this to a couple of names that probably, if you're like me, were not just right there in your lips, immediately. The Hellenists and Hebrews. This is not language you use anymore, because this is language that only fit back when we were Jews, when everybody in the faith was Jews. And we had two types of Jews. We had the Hebrews were basically Palestinian Jews that lived in that area, Jerusalem, Galilee, that area. They speak Hebrew. Actually, they probably spoke Aramaic, worship in Hebrew. And they had kind of one set of values, one kind of approach to the faith. There were many more Jews who were spread out across the empire. These were the Hellenists, Luke calls them. These are the Greek-speaking Jews of the diaspora. They are very different. But they're both part of Judaism. And they would come back, as we remember the Pentecost story. And at Pentecost, we're told there was about 120 believers. Those were the Hebrews. And then all of a sudden, there's 3,000 of the Hellenists. And this is a portent of the future, because Christian faith never really grew that much among the Hebrews. Where it took off like a rocket was with the Hellenists. And the Hellenists then become the segue to the God-fearers, who become a segue just to the Gentiles and the gospel. And Luke's going to tell us that story. We were introduced to the first of a series of remarkable Hellenistic figures. We're going to have Stephen today. We're going to have Philip next week. Remember a guy named Paul? Remember a guy named Barnabas? These are very key figures. All these stories are absolutely critical. And what happens with them, you can see the foundations shaking and change is afoot. And we have the first of these this morning. We ended last week. Stephen got arrested for, in the opinion of the temple authorities, attacking the foundations of the Jewish faith, which is weird, considering Stephen's a Jew. He's a Hellenistic Jew, but he's a Jew. Jewish leaders accusing another Jew of attacking the Jewish faith, the very foundations of it. Today we're going to turn to Stephen's speech and this trial and his martyrdom. And it's basically his defense speech, which is not a defense speech. It's actually an attack that he launches into at his trial. And that's going to result in his martyrdom. But it's really what we're going to focus on today, the speech. Somebody asked me, it came in, what's the deal about Stephen's speech? Why did he get in so much trouble? Well, it's not any one thing. It's the entire speech. And so we want to kind of go through that. It is one of the most remarkable and shocking passages in the New Testament. Absolute consensus on that out there in the scholarly world. You'll see why in a few minutes. What it does do, though, is that Stephen's speech gives us an insight, because it's the first time we have a Hellenist speaking and telling us what they believe, what they think, what their values are. And it turns out what they believe and think and their values are fundamentally different from the Hebrews. And it is this difference that's actually going to get him in trouble. And as we also know from reading the book of Luke further, it is the Hellenists who are the gateway to the world for the faith. They are the future. The Hebrews in 70 AD are going to be taken off the face of the earth by Rome when Rome comes in to quell the rebellion. And who's left? And they're all over the empire. And so this is the story of the Genesis. So for the first time, we have the voice of a Hellenist. That by itself would be worth it, priceless. When the high priest asked him, okay, he's in there, he's in the temple, before the Sanhedrin, which meets in the temple, he's been accused of attacking the faith. the high priest. This is a high-profile trial. Now, the under-assistant junior flunky handling this fight. He's got the big boy there. Are these things so? Because I've heard some very disturbing things. Stephen replied, brothers and sisters, listen up. This is where it gets interesting. Now, Stephen is one of the seven Hellenistic leaders. Remember the table waiters? He's not table waiting today, by the way. He's preaching, and he's preaching radically, you know. He's now been arrested. He's been brought before the Jewish council. He's been accused of attacking the foundation of faith. Remember last week, he's accused of attacking God, Moses, the law, and the temple. Did he miss anything? You know, that's pretty much the quadfecta right there, right off the bat, you know. Any one of these brings the death penalty. Now, remember last week, we talked about blasphemy. We think about blasphemy as being against God. Who was awake last week? He was blasphemous against who? Moses. Josephus tells us that actually blasphemy against Moses trumped blasphemy against God, because that was the first charge. You blaspheme against Moses, you shall be put to death. This is a serious trial, and there's a lot at stake here. And every time I read this story, I hope for a different ending, and it doesn't happen. Okay. So, Leviticus. Take the blasphemer outside the camp. Let all who were within hearing lay hands on his head, and let the whole congregation stone him. That is the price for blasphemy. And we've been told speaking against Moses and against the temple and against the law, all of that is blasphemy. The question before the council is, are the charges true? I don't know about you, but at this point, I would launch into a really good defense, right? Because there's a lot on the block here. But it turns out this is not what happens in the story. Stephen is now given a chance to defend himself, but rather than do that, he attacks. The very thing he's been accused of doing, and the high priest says, is it true? He's now going to underline it in spades and says, absolutely true. Okay. For his defense, he's going to narrate the history of Israel. A lot of these in the Old Testament, Psalms have them, other places, but what's interesting is there's a lot of history there, isn't there? So what you choose to emphasize and what you choose to delete says a lot. This is a selective telling of the history of Israel. He wants to lift up certain things and certain things he does not lift up. And again, very unusual, very selective way of doing this. A way that no one, that could not possibly be more offensive, and it's going to guarantee his immediate death. By the end of this speech, if you are a first century Palestinian Jewish temple leader, there is no question. There's only one outcome that we can have here. Now, Stephen begins with this, with the beginning of Jewish history. Abraham. Can I have an amen? Father Abraham. Remember the Gospel of Matthew? We narrate the story of Jesus. We go from Abraham to David, David to the exile, exile to Jesus. So Jewish history goes back to the calling of Abraham. This is what he has to say about Abraham. Again, selective, but very interesting. The God of glory appeared to our ancestor Abraham. Okay, there's no problem with that part. We like this. When he was in Mesopotamia. True? Ur of the Chaldees. Yeah. Where a lot of our soldiers went during the Iraq War. And said to him, leave this, your country and your relatives, and go to the land that I will show you. He left the country of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. So far, we are tracking the book of Genesis exactly. After his father died, God said to him, move from there to this country in which you are now living. God did not give Abraham any of it as a heritage. Say it again. God did not, what's the it? The promised land. God did not give the promised land as a heritage to Abraham. Not even a single foot. I'm thinking there's rustling out there in the crowd already. And God spoke in these terms, that his descendants would be citizens, resident aliens in the country belonging to others. All of which at one level is totally true because it was occupied by another group who would enslave them and mistreat them during 400 years. Now we're over in Egypt. But I will judge the nation that they serve, said God, and after that they shall come out and worship me. We're now in the book of Exodus in this place. Where's this place? Sinai. Not in Israel, not in the temple, Sinai. Remember the story? Let my people go so they can worship me. They go to Sinai. Now, the key to the Abraham story, as Stephen narrates it, is geography, not genealogy. For traditional Jews, what is it? It's genealogy. Father Abraham. We are descendants of Abraham. So already you can see that there's a parting of the ways here. Stephen has carefully edited the Abraham story so that he only narrates the parts where Abraham is outside the promised land. He omits any reference to Abraham being in the promised land. He highlights God's activity in Mesopotamia, in Haran, in Egypt, and Sinai. Where's the one place he does not say God is? Flag that. Because he's going to circle back and it's going to be a killer move in a few minutes. He omits any reference to God being active in Palestine. Stephen won't even name it. Geography, not genealogy. He's moving in a different direction here. He simply refers to it as this country in which you are now living. How's that for dodging the issue, you know? Yeah. Then he goes out of his way to say that Abraham has no claim on the land of Israel, not even one foot. How do you think that's going down with the temple authorities? Okay. He's just getting warmed up. Okay. Stephen's narration, Abraham was never part of the promised land. He wasn't even an Israelite. He was what? A resident alien. Okay. You know. That's a wanky kind of way of reading Israel's history, isn't it? Okay, but again, this is Act 1 of 4 Acts, okay? Now, resident aliens is the term for foreigners who live outside the borders, for Gentiles who are living in the land, which is a way of saying, for Stephen, Abraham is not a Jew, he is a Gentile, a resident alien outside of that. He concludes by affirming that God is to be worshipped where? In Jerusalem, in Israel, in the temple? We're a little anachronistic. A temple doesn't exist, but not even Jerusalem. We're going to worship God in this place, which happens to be Mount Sinai. Not in the Holy Land, not in Jerusalem, not in the temple, but outside in another place entirely. God is to be worshipped outside of the Holy Land. Flag that, because he's going to circle back, and in the final act, he's going to drive this point home. That God is not the God of Israel, is not the God of Jerusalem. He is the God of the outsider and of Sinai. Stephen's version, the Abraham story, tells us that God is present and active outside of Israel and is to be worshipped outside of Israel. Next, fast forward a little bit. We skip Isaac, we skip Jacob, and we go right to Joseph. We're going to dip into the Joseph story now. So he picks up and continues. The patriarchs, who would they be? Sunday School 101, folks. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Yeah. And since this is Joseph, it's the ones before him. The patriarchs, jealous of Joseph, sold him into slavery. Who sold him into slavery? His own people. In the first century, we'd call those people Jews. Okay, there's a theme developing here. But God was with him and rescued him from all of his afflictions, enabled him to win favor when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And again, the focus is activity. There's a lot of the story that takes place in Palestine, but Stephen's not interested in that. What's the one piece of the story he picks up? The end of the story when Joseph is where? In Egypt, outside the land. God is active. God rescues Joseph in Egypt. Something even more disturbing in Stephen's version of the story of Joseph. Joseph's problems were caused by who? Okay. And who rescued him? The bad people are the Jews. The good people are the Gentiles. Little revisionist history here. Stephen's narration, Jewish ancestors are the bad guys, patriarchs, the ones who sold him into slavery, technically true. the Gentile Pharaoh is the good guy. He rescues Joseph and what the patriarchs did. Now we're going to fast forward down to Moses, another good biblical character, Acts 7, verse 20. At this time, Moses was born, and he was beautiful before God. Isn't that a wonderful? Beautiful before God, beautiful before the Lord. For 3 months, he was brought up in his father's house. Then he was... That's not in Genesis. Who abandoned him? His family. Who adopted him? Gentile. Brought him up as her own son. Again, Jewish history is rewritten in a way that reflects poorly on the Jews. Moses is abandoned by his own people, his father and his mother. If you follow the story, it'd be his mother and his sister, and they didn't really abandon him, but this is Stephen's story. He was adopted, taken care of by a Gentile. And then later, when Moses tries to rescue an Israelite, remember what happens? The Israelite turns and betrays Moses and attacks him. That is in Genesis. Acts 7. But the man who was wronging his neighbor pushed Moses aside, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" When he heard this, Moses fled, became a resident alien in the land of Midian. Like Joseph, Moses is mistreated by the Jewish people, his family. He's abandoned by his Jewish parents. He has to flee to Egypt, the wilderness, not because of Egyptians harassing him. That's the movie version. Remember that? The Disney version? He gets chased out there. In this version, it's a little different because of a fellow Israelite. Moses then becomes a resident alien. In Midian, as a resident alien in a foreign land, that's when he encounters God. The burning bush is not in Jerusalem. The burning bush is the land of Midian on Mount Sinai. Stephen now turns to this encounter. Verse 33. Then the Lord said to him, "Take off your sandals off your feet, for the place where you're standing is what?" So what ground is holy? Not Israel. Not Jerusalem. Not the temple. In the land of Midian. As he did with Abraham, as he did with Joseph, Stephen spotlights that God is present and active outside Palestine. It is this foreign land that is, in fact, holy ground. That is in the Bible, by the way. He has also identified each of the great figures of Israel's history as resident aliens of their day, not as citizens. Stephen now turns his attention to the golden calf incident. Not Israel's best moment, okay? And by the way, we need to be careful here because it's the golden calf moment that serves as a paradigm for what he's going to say later. And so there's some language here. There's some imagery that he wants to pick up from this story. And he wants to then apply. And by the way, it's this reference that probably got him killed to this story. Our ancestors were unwilling to obey Moses. Instead, they pushed him aside. And in their hearts, they turned back to Egypt. So who are these people? So we're lifting up a negative story about them, not our best moment as people of God, saying to Aaron, "Make gods for us who will lead the way for us." At that time, they made a calf, offered a sacrifice to the idol, and reveled in the works of their hands. Flag these words, the works of their hands. Because in this story, what does that refer to? Yeah, it's not something God made, it's something we made. What did we make? We made an idol. Stephen introduces the key phrase to describe the golden calf, the works of our hands. This is the phrase that's going to be absolutely critical for the rest of the speech. It carries very special meaning in Israel. It's a term that he will use again in a pivotal place. And then Stephen ends by lifting up the period of wanderness in the wilderness. Before they entered Israel, before they're in the promised land, they're just wandering around out there in the bushes, directionally challenged. Does it take you 40 years to cross Sinai? Yeah. Of course, the book of Exodus says that they actually the book of Numbers, they spent 37 years Kadesh Barnea, so they weren't wandering the entire time. But the golden age for this writer, for Stephen, is before we were in the Holy Land, before we had a temple, before we were in Jerusalem, before any of that, that's the golden age. Okay, this is what he wants to lift up. Our ancestors had the tent of testimony in the wilderness. Do you remember where that came from? That's what God told them to build at Mount Sinai. And that's what all that stuff is in Leviticus. About building, you know, infinite details. If you ever have insomnia, Leviticus is the cure, I guarantee. And it's this part right here. Okay. But the idea here is this is what God wanted, which implies God did not want what? We're going to get there. Okay, we're headed there. When he spoke to Moses, ordering him to make it according to the pattern he had seen. Where did he see it? Where'd the pattern come from? Okay. God's given him the pattern at Mount Sinai. God showed him what this should be. Our ancestors, in turn, brought the tent of the testimony in with Joshua, and it was there until the time of David. So all the time of the Joshua and Judges and all that, you know, all this for this writer and for some other Old Testament writers, this is the good times. This is the way they existed for hundreds of years. Now, the tent of testimony, we also call the tabernacle, is made according to divine pattern, the pattern that Moses had seen in heaven. By the way, there's an inference here. If I'm in the vision, seeing heaven, and I see the pattern, and I'm going to recreate from the pattern something down here, where is the real one? Yeah. Dead Sea Scrolls, Qumran community, believe the same thing. They believe the temple in Jerusalem was false, led by the evil priest, and so when they prayed and worked themselves into a mystical chant, and that it's called the Songs of Sabbath Sacrifice, they would in the vision, they would take themselves into heaven, because where was the real temple? With God. And the one down below, not so good, okay? So they would agree here. This is built as God directed. This is what God wanted. This is God's desire for worship. And it was way, and we're told that this is the way it was for hundreds of years. And that tracks with the Old Testament. That is until somebody screwed it up. Who might that somebody be? And what did they do? Stephen now drops the bombshell right here, Acts 7. But it was Solomon who built a house for him. Yet the Most High does not dwell in houses. You can build it, but is God in it? Made with human hands. What is the temple according to Stephen? It's an idol. And God is not in it. Anybody surprised that within 30 minutes Stephen was dead? This is first century Second Temple Judaism. They've destroyed all the other temples anywhere in Palestine and beyond. They've centralized worship into one temple. They believe that God can only be worshipped in one place in the entire world, and that way, through the sacrifice, through the priests. And this is why Jews from all over the Roman Empire have to come back for Pentecost and for, you know, Passover and all that kind of thing. Everything is utterly, totally focused. That's where God is. That's where things are done. Not only is the temple not what God wanted, it is not God in it, it is in fact an idol. It's another golden calf, according to Stephen spin. By the way, Stephen's not alone in this. There are many strands within the Old Testament that agree to this. Now, in the language of the golden calf area, Stephen has just called it an idol. That's pretty darn clear. And just like the golden calf, made with human hands, we can put that together. The leader of the temple would have clearly understood this reference. Now, why? Well, it turns out that this is part of their history. Let's just set up a couple of examples that you can actually find close to 100 of in the Old Testament. Jeremiah 1:16. They have made offerings to other gods and worshipped the works of their hands, a condemnation of idolatry. Psalm 115, their idols of silver and gold, the work of their hands. So when Stephen starts using this language, it's not news to them. This is not rocket science for these leaders. They know exactly what he's saying. And I'm thinking they've pretty much got him correct. Stephen says the temple of Jerusalem is made in human hands. God does not dwell in it. It's clear as a bell what he's trying to say. Now, earlier he had been accused of speaking against the temple. That's the reason he's on trial. How's he doing for a defense? Okay. Acts 6:13. This man never stopped saying things against the holy place. I think if you can say nothing else about Stephen, he is utterly, totally consistent. Okay. He does not change his tune at all. The charges against him are true. And for this, by Jewish law, is there any doubt what the outcome of this story is, although we'd like it to be different. Verse 54. When they heard these things, they became enraged and ground their teeth. That's such a visceral image. You ground their teeth at Stephen. You know. With a loud shout, all rushed together against him. They dragged him outside of the city, just as Leviticus said we should do, and they began to stone him. And then we get this interpretive part here. While they were stoning Stephen, he prayed, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. Any bells going off? Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Okay. He knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So how is Luke portraying Stephen? Junior Jesus being crucified again. In other words, what happens to the disciple Jesus is exact. And this is intentional. He's being portrayed as a Christ-like figure who, for his faith, just like Jesus, meets the same outcome with that. When he had said this, he died. And again, the Gospels. Jesus breathed his last and then died. Devout men buried Stephen, made loud lamentation over him. Now, there's some jewels here we need to kind of dig out. Luke parallels Stephen's death to the death of Jesus. Stephen says the same thing that Jesus said when he was dying on the cross. God asked him, you know, to forgive, receive his spirit. So obviously, there's an intended parallel. But this is what's really weird. Luke does not give us one iota shred of evidence that any other believer came to Stephen's defense. Does that strike you? Yeah. It's obvious. Yeah. I'm thinking after that speech, I might be looking for a rock to crawl under myself, you know, but there's no evidence of that. He's buried by devout men. And by the way, there's no reason to believe these are fellow believers in Christ. Because we know from Tobit and many other sources that in the Second Temple period, one of the key characteristics of being a good Jew is you cannot let a body of a Jew lie unburied. It must be buried by sundown. That's what a good Jew does. So the book of Tobit is a whole book built around that premise. Yeah. No corpse could go unburied. So likely what he's referring to here is not other believers. This is not Christians coming at the last minute. These are just Jews, maybe some of whom tossed rocks, who think, okay, we dealt with him, he's gone. But our Jewish heritage tells us we must bury him. That has to be done. Luke pointedly does not mention their brothers. It would have been so easy to say the brothers, which is a term for other Christians. It's not the brothers. It's pious men. It seemed possible that the Hebrew believers of Jesus may have consented to Stephen's death. This would explain Luke's challenge. That's a bit of a reach, but it's not too big of a reach, you know. If you are more of a traditional Jew like the Hebrews, how would you embrace what Stephen just said in his speech? You're probably thinking, he needs to go. He's a threat to our heritage. The issue behind Stephen's story is that there are two fundamentally different ways of viewing what it means to be God's people. And by the way, both of these are in the Old Testament. One view is found in Ezra and Nehemiah and Ezekiel, which is we are to remain pure, we're to remain holy, we put outside the community anything that is unclean, and we circle the wagons, and that's how we beat God's people. The other tradition, which is found in the prophets, particularly Isaiah and Zechariah is that we're to be a light to the Gentiles. You know, the Abraham story, we're to be what? A blessing to the nations. There were two fundamental, and in this story, within Judaism, both are there. We've got the Hebrew and the Hellenist. The Hebrews are following the heritage of Ezra and Nehemiah and Ezekiel, and it looks like the Hellenists have picked up on the heritage of Isaiah, Zephaniah, and the other part of the prophetic tradition. The end of the story, Luke leaves us with two things that are going to be crucial for the remainder of Acts. First, he's going to introduce to us a character who will dominate the remainder of Acts. This guy, he's a Hellenist, Paul of Tarsus. By the way, he's not introduced in a particularly flattering way in this. You know. He's introduced as an enemy to faith. So Acts, pick up a couple passages here. The eyewitnesses laid their coats at the feet of a young man named Saul, and Saul approved their killing. Now, just for a second, work with me. A group of people get rocks and go after it. They give all their coats to this guy standing on the side. What do you now know about the guy on the side? What? Trusted by them? Agrees with them? Who's in charge of the execution? Best guess is Saul is in charge. He's been given, and Paul confirms this in his own writings. We're going to look at this, you know. Saul was ravaging the church by entering house after house, dragging off both men and women committed into prison. So it's not a big of a, much of a reach to say that Paul likely, we don't know for sure, but likely could have been in charge of this group. In his letters, he confirms this view of him, that he persecuted the church. There's several. I'm just going to give you one, Galatians 1. You have heard, no doubt, in my earlier life in Judaism, I violently persecuted the church of God. And he adds there, because I was zealous for the Lord. I was trying to destroy the church. Second thing Luke does is he lets us know that the death of Stephen results in a persecution that has an unlikely outcome. Now, has anybody ever tried to stomp a fire ant mound? Stomp a fire ant mound. How does that work? I generally wound up running the other direction trying to shake things off my legs. You know, kind of the image of a fire ant mound is actually, there's a biblical scholar who went to seminary here at Perkins about 40 years ago, and you can tell he's a Texas boy because he uses this image in a commentary. It's going to dominate the rest of Acts. Acts 8:1. That day a severe persecution began against the church in Jerusalem, and all were scattered throughout the countryside of Judea and Samaria except the apostles. We want to look at that. Why except the apostles? Well, first of all, let's just back up the fact they were scared. How successful were they exterminating this movement? Spread it. Remember the book of Acts? They come from all over the world. 3,000 are converted. Where do they go? This is the second wave. We're going to stomp it out. Didn't work. In fact, we've spread. It's like in surgery. You have to be careful about cancer. If you don't get everything, it spreads. What about the apostles? Scholars have some interesting insights here that I'm convinced of. Luke seems to indicate that the Stephen incident and the persecution and the scattering is limited to the Hellenists and the synagogue of the freedmen. Remember that from last week? In other words, this is a controversy. You got the Hebrews are worshiping one synagogue because they speak what? Aramaic, Hebrew, yeah. And you got the Hellenists, at least in five synagogues that we know of in Jerusalem, because their language is Greek. You can't worship together because you can't understand each other. Where does the controversy break out? One Hellenistic synagogue, the synagogue of the freedmen. This is where it broke out. This is the group that seized Stephen. This is the group that hauled him before the council and stoned him. The apostles, probably the Hebrews as a group, were unaffected. Because if this happens internally in this synagogue, across town there's another synagogue, does that affect them? And by the way, where would the apostles be? Which synagogue? The Hebrews. Makes sense? They're not affected. They don't have to leave. But if you're a member of the synagogue of the freedmen, you had better get out of Dodge really quick. You know. So most likely it was a different synagogue. You may or may not buy that, but it makes sense to me. So what we have depicted is the purge limited to a Hellenistic synagogue, possibly all the Hellenistic synagogues, but at least that one. They removed the Jesus believers from the Hellenistic synagogue of the freedmen. And the idea here is, in the synagogue of the freedmen, we are going to be Jews. And this new Jesus movement, we're not going to accept. And so we're going to purge that element from us. After the expulsion, the Christian community of Jerusalem is now made up only of Hebrews. And that may or may not be true. It's very possible there were other Hellenistic synagogues that were not affected. But I'm thinking, if you're the temple leadership and this stuff erupts in one synagogue, you're probably going to go after it. And that's probably what Paul was doing. Again, the irony is it didn't work. All you managed to do was to spread the faith further. It leads to spreading faith by the Hellenists who scattered. And now Acts is going to give us a series of snapshots that are going to let us know what was the result of the death of Stephen. Acts 8:1. All except the apostles were scattered throughout the countryside of Judea and Samaria. Any of you read Acts a little further? Where are these stories going to be taking place? Judea and Samaria. Acts 8:4. Now those who were scattered went from place to place, proclaiming the word, so they're not being silent. They're out there spreading this new gospel. Chapter 11, Luke lets us know. Now those who were scattered because of the persecution that took place over Stephen, so it's clear it's saying, they go as far as Phoenicia. Where's that? Coast, Lebanon today, northern Israel. Cyprus, we know where that is. Antioch, up in what is today Asia Minor, up there in the hook. Among them were some men from Cyprus and Cyrene. Cyrene's northern Africa, who in coming to Antioch spoke to the Hellenists also, proclaiming the Lord Jesus. So did we exterminate the movement? No. They're just now out there across the Roman world beginning to evangelize. This is all pre-Paul. The Hellenist Jesus believers driven out, synagogue, probably 32, 33, somewhere in that time frame, and are driven into the mission to other Hellenists of the diaspora. The church now has two centers, Jerusalem, mother church of the Hebrew Christians, and Antioch, mother church of the Hellenists. And it's Antioch that's going to play this huge role in the rest of the book of Acts, and particularly the story of Paul. Antioch is the church that's going to launch the Gentile mission, the church that includes Barnabas, it includes Paul. And in chapter 8, Luke will now turn his attention to another Hellenist, one who's scattered, and he didn't go quite as far, a guy by the name of Philip. Remember him? His story is also incredibly interesting. So we've got a couple of minutes if you want to kick. Yes. Early. If Jesus died in 30... I don't think any scholar I know would date it later than 32 or 33, possibly even in the same year. Roughly the same time. Probably within a year or two. I mean, the faith has to get established enough that it's identified. It gets opposition. Paul gets drawn into the opposition. We're already told he's been persecuting for a while before. So now all that can happen pretty quickly. Or it might happen over a couple of years, but early. Very, and that's where Luke puts it. Luke puts it kind of at the beginning. And then the rest of the story flows from there. Yeah. And here it won't. Yeah, and that basically is God's job. That's God's job. God sends prophets. And God's up there going, oy vey. You know, God, yeah. What's going on down there? Send a, you know, there was a lot, and the Bible's incredibly honest about this. It is not a sanitized, whitewashed storyline. Our dirty laundry is in there. And one of the things you see with the way God is portrayed is, this is the purpose of the prophets. And you could even argue, this is the purpose of John the Baptist. This is the purpose of Jesus. This is the purpose of the call of Paul, to bring them back to a vision of the faith that is consistent with God's original vision for what God wanted God's people to be. And clearly, at least elements of the Jewish community at that time had lost that, repeatedly lost it, which is why you have to send prophets again and again and again and again. Yes. The prophets themselves, the Book of Kings, some of the writings in the Apocrypha, it's a major theme out there. Yeah. But yeah, there's, I can't quote a verse right now, but what you'll see many times, some parts of the Bible have one view, the circle of the wagons, Ezra, Nehemiah, Ezekiel. Other parts have the more Isaiah, Zephaniah, the open. And then you'll have sometime in the Bible a little dialogue acknowledging both groups and saying that, you know, here's God's vision and here's where we've gone astray. And by the way, I would argue that Christian history hasn't changed. We have had that same ongoing struggle. We've had our prophets. We've had our Martin Luther Kings. We've had people that kind of call. What are they calling us back to? They're calling it back to God's original vision. I mean, Paul can say, in Christ there is no slave, nor free, nor Greek, nor man, male or female. We're still working that one out, you know. But it's the vision. But it's as long as God insists on working with people, it's a struggle. Yeah, it's a struggle. Remember the children of Israel? Drug screaming and complaining out of Egypt into the promised land the entire way, saying, we want to go back to Egypt. We got steak there, you know. Yeah. So it's a major biblical narrative. So yeah, you've hit a big one. Yeah. Yeah.
As I remember,
they were excluded. I don't know if they were stoned. There's the story in John of the woman caught in adultery. Adultery and prostitution would be probably separate issues. Yeah. 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 My thinking, yeah, the question is how long would it take for somebody to stone to die? Well, not long, probably. Depending on the stones, depending on who threw them, you know. Because stoning could be chucking rocks. It also could be picking up a great boulder and just going over there and, you know. We're actually told in Paul's letters that once he was stoned and left for dead. So Paul was stoned once. He got lots of other things. And they thought he was dead, but he actually survived. Yeah, yeah. Rocks can be big, yeah.
Did Josephus verify that there was a real Stephen?
No. Josephus doesn't. Josephus mentions James, the brother of the Lord, Jesus, and John the Baptist. Those are the only three I can remember him mentioning. Yeah. So a lot of this is the only source we have. And that's true for a lot of Acts. I honestly don't know.
Because they both had a better way of making their point by not defending themselves than by talking themselves out.
Yeah, kind of a pacifist option. Yeah. Although it's a pretty aggressive pacifist. Would you stand? God of grace, God of glory.